This is the AWS podcast. I'm Jeff Barr. Today I'm interviewing Nick Badger of Mutera. We're sitting in the basement of the AWS loft in San Francisco, and this recording is part of the Intel Startup Spotlight. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your what Mutera does.
Right. So there's the company. So there's this trend in startups recently where a startup will produce a single kind of eponymous product, right? So Facebook, the company, is known for Facebook, the app; Twitter, the company, Twitter, the app, and so on. So that's something that I'm for a variety of reasons trying to avoid. So there's Mutera, the company, and then we have a protocol that we've developed called, I say we, but I'm the only person in the company right now. So, but we've developed this this protocol called Muse. And on top of that, we're building, kind of co-evolving, a social network called Ether. And Muse is, by a significant margin, the most interesting of the three. It's an open, decentralized social protocol that does a lot of privacy. I hesitate to say guarantees, because anytime in the security realm, if you say guarantees, it's like not a good thing to say. But it makes a lot of assurances about privacy that are all rooted in cryptography, as opposed to privacy by promise, which is the reigning paradigm for even the open, decentralized social networking protocols that have been done already, like Diaspora or Tent is another one. There's several others. So it's a really interesting protocol. The kind of the core idea behind it is to consolidate all of the shared social infrastructure that any social application has to have, which is basically content management, sharing management, and identity management, and bring it together into one shared roof that's transport agnostic and application agnostic. So it's all about interoperability, and you can jump between things and do a lot of really interesting stuff with it.
What was your background before you started doing this that led you to this point, and you said, this is the thing I need to do next?
So that's actually a really funny question. I went to school for mechanical engineering, and I got my, and actually German. I got a BSE in mechanical engineering and a BA in German. I left grad school. There's kind of long backstory behind this, but I left grad school within a month prior to defending my thesis, and abandoned my dissertation. And that was also in mechanical engineering. And so my background is in like robotics, autonomous vehicles, a little bit hybrid vehicles. I did a lot of car stuff, and biomechanics. The lab I was doing my grad work out of was a biorobotics lab. So even just within the mechanical realm, a very varied background. But I wanted to move west, so I pretty much hopped on my motorcycle and left. And on the way, I got a job at the company that I was working at until a little over a month ago, doing producing scientific instrumentation for climatology research. And I was a project manager as well as a mechanical engineer. It wasn't the most interesting thing, but you know, it's a lot easier to find a new job than move across the country. But in the process of being there, originally I'd started out working out on for my own kind of side projects. I had started working on basically collaboration tools. The state of mechanical engineering software is really, really, really atrocious for a huge variety of reasons. And so I started working on trying to improve that and looking at what that would mean, even as much as like I wrote 70%. I had a viable approach to a merge tool for Git for SolidWorks files, which is a really cool thing to be able to do. And I was using Git for my version control for SolidWorks and stuff like that, because I had a lot of leeway at the company. It was a 12-person company, so... and as I started working on that, the more and more I looked at it, you know, it's that here's this problem. Collaboration, mechanical engineering is a very difficult thing to do. Software tools suck. None of it integrates with collaboration. Okay, that's cool. I started looking at that, and then I started looking at what that means from the collaboration side of things. And it's like, okay, well, if I'm going to try and roll Git out, using Git as an example, to a bunch of mechanical engineers, what kind of hangups are you going to run into? And the answer is a lot of them.
So is the assumption here that these engineers at this point don't understand version control and things of that nature?
It's not so much that. It's that I actually have a lot of kind of, I guess you could say, complaints about the way version control has been done, that I've used it. The way that I think about version control, and pretty much every other mechanical engineer that I've talked to thinks about it, is it's state management. I think most software engineers think about it this way too. It's state management, right? So you say, I want to create a snapshot of this thing that I'm working on at this present time. And the problem is that every version control system I've used is in fact process management behind the scenes. Now, whether or not you use it as that is a totally different question. I was talking to a friend of mine who works at Yahoo, and he was saying, no, all of our deployment tools are set up such that we're kind of caressing Git into behaving like it's state management. But that's kind of inherently wrong, right? You're trying to, I understand that they have to make use of the tools that they have, right? So from the perspective of Yahoo, no, absolutely right answer. But if you're going out to design a version control system, it's the total wrong approach, because you have people essentially hacking out pieces of your software to remove functionality, right? Which is not the, you know, if you're just building on things, right? If you have to create some kludged add functionality, oh, that happens all the time. But if you're, you know, just throwing something together to remove something that someone else has put together, that's, I think, a very strong indication of a poor choice of abstraction.
Like warning sign.
Yeah, exactly. And so looking at version control systems like that, every time I've talked to, I got a coworker of mine who's relatively technically inclined, but not particularly with software necessarily. And I was getting him up to speed on Git, and we were using it, and we were collaborating with Git with SolidWorks, which was a pretty cool thing. But he was constantly struggling, partly against the interface, but I think more against the actual core fundamentals of Git, because Git is all about process management. You know, if you're doing something like rebasing, you're not really saying, or at least I don't think people are normally saying, hey, I want to actually change history. What they're saying is, I want the new state. I want to create a new state, and in that state, I want it to behave as if history were changed.
Right.
Right. And so the fundamentals of Git don't allow you to do that. So I was looking at that question, and then simultaneously, I had just constantly been, I've never really been that content with social networking. So simultaneously, I had this question running in my head of like, okay, what would the world look like if there was an end-to-end encrypted social network, right? And I kind of had that idea buzzing around in my head for a little while, but the mechanical engineering side of things was a higher priority to me. And then as soon as I sat down and said, you know, wait a second, even in mechanical engineering, you're still going to run into the problem of how do you do the collaboration tools, then it started to dawn on me that, yeah, actually collaboration tools are a way better, you know, place to go in. And then that idea of doing collaboration right kind of merged with the idea of an encrypted social network, and then it kind of spiraled from there into the protocol that I've now written.
Okay, so let's dive into that a bit. So encrypted social network protocol, what does that really mean in practice? What is it? What are the objects, the entities, how does it all fit together?
So like I said earlier, there's content management, there's identity management, and access management. Access management is essentially this. When you talk about the way it's implemented cryptographically, access management and sharing management are the same thing. And so in contrast to, say, Diaspora or any of those federated distributed social networking protocols that have been written, the way that those all work is you have kind of a standard web stack. So you have, and some of them actually deploy on a specific like stack, right? So some of them, if you download, I think Diaspora is one of the ones that actually specifies, has pre-built stacks where you just deploy it on a server and it's like, okay, now you have an Apache front end, and so on and so forth. And so they have this, they're operating kind of a standard web stack, and it's exactly like if you're trying to build a version of Facebook where instead of Facebook throwing all of their stuff behind their own load balancer and they have to communicate between their servers and do state management that way, instead of doing it that way, everyone spools up their own server and does this kind of federated state management
so
between everyone.
Each participant is almost like a microserver in
effect. Exactly. And so that's very awkward, to say the least. It doesn't scale particularly well, and it's not something you can reasonably expect people to do. The privacy of that whole thing, just like, well, the web in general right now, with some exceptions, but they're few and far between, the entire privacy of that paradigm is based upon the assumption that whoever owns that server is not going to share your stuff, mm-hmm. right? So it's a pretty unreasonable expectation to have the, whatever is, 1.5 billion users of Facebook, each and every one of them have their own server. right? So there's always going to be some degree of centralization, and pretty quickly you arrive back at the same question of, all right, well, I'm storing my data that I care about on someone else's server, and I have to trust them to do this. So my protocol, in contrast to that, it says, no. You can store it on any server. It's going to be encrypted from the entity that you are to the entity you're trying to communicate with. So you don't actually have to care about where it's stored. So you can have a centralizable platform, but you can also distribute it as much as you want. If you want to run your own server, go for it. And then there are specific side protocols set up to facilitate the communication between servers to have shared state between them.
And this would then give me very specific control of who I decide to share my information with.
Yeah, so it does. It's in a way, it's a very low-level thing. So it gives you exact control because everything... so it's kind of like PGP over email in that sense, right? So PGP over email, you write your email, and then you have a set of public keys. You find the public key for whoever you're sending the email to. You actually symmetrically encrypt the email, and then you asymmetrically, for optimization reasons, asymmetric encryption is very slow. So you symmetrically encrypt the body of the email, and then you asymmetrically encrypt the key for the email based upon the public keys that you pulled down from whatever key database that you are querying. So you have to explicitly spell out, okay, this person gets access to the main body with this one key. It's all the same key for the main body, but you have to encrypt in each case an access key for the people that you're giving access to the email to. So it's kind of like that in the sense that you have to actually explicitly lay out each and every person that you're sending it to. Now, the difference between PGP and email versus what I'm doing is that with what I'm doing, the body of the email is completely and totally separate from the access control, which is a really important thing because PGP over email... Okay, so for example, you can't use that with a mailing list, right? If I shoot off an email, PGP encrypted email to a mailing list, my only option to do that is to encrypt the email against a public key for the mailing list. And then the mailing list has a script running that decrypts the email and then knows every single public key of everyone on the email list, re-encrypts it and resends it,
which is very expensive.
Yeah, it's a very overhead intensive process, and it doesn't work particularly well. So, and it's all contained within that singular email. And then in the end, because, you know, let's say the mailing list has 1,000 recipients, now you'll have 1,000 lines of PGP encrypted keys on your email, and that's going to be a very, very, very large file. So in contrast to that, splitting out the access control entirely allows you to have a much more efficient and much more scalable sense of, you know, this, whatever piece of content this is. In my case, it's all binary based. I'm trying to stay as low as possible. Whatever piece of content this is, if you want to grant someone access to it, they don't have to deal with all the overhead of every other person that it's been sent access to.
So this sounds like it gives you a lot of protection and a lot of control. How do you then balance the ease of use side of, like, you don't necessarily need to exercise every one of those options?
Yeah, exactly.
You want to share a bit of it.
Exactly. So that's kind of one of the critical things about it, is that this is intended to be a fairly low-level protocol. So if you're building something like the social network that I'm building on top of it, there's a lot of automation that goes in that process. And as I was saying earlier about, you know, don't hack away functionality, that's a problem, hack to build on top of it. It's much more that ethos where you can build layers of automation on top of a very basic fundament much more easily than you can have an erroneous automation that you don't need to need, that you don't need to have, and then remove it. So it's taking that strategy where at the very low level, yes, okay, you have to open up. For example, there's this concept of an API pipeline, basically. So every communicating entity on the network opens up a pipeline, an encrypted pipeline in between each other. And that's just a one-to-one conversation that's happening, and then you get a, kind of the mesh network arises from that. And within that is where you're doing your key sharing. And so when you have that approach, it's a much more scalable way of doing things. And it allows you to then build the automation of that API pipeline into whatever application you're developing.
Okay. So you're really simultaneously defining the protocol and then building the app.
I really don't think you can have a protocol. I don't think you can consider a protocol to be in any way, shape, or form mature until you have an application for it that has actually done something with it. And then also, critically, from a business perspective, good luck selling a protocol. I mean, if you've got a brand new protocol that no one's ever used before, it's like, oh, I have this great thing. Okay, that's cool. Now, how do you make money off of it? And it's a really tough sell to come up to a business and say, like, if I'm some startup and I'm trying to make Yo, right? Then it's a really tough sell to be like, hey, Yo, you could do that in, like, I don't know, 100 lines of code on this. And it's like, oh, that sounds great. Okay, I'm going to do it my own way anyway, right? Because there's just no momentum behind it.
So what are you trying to focus on with the social network side?
I'm focusing on two things that really bother me in the social networks that I've seen. Granularity and explicit and transparent sharing, right? So knowing exactly who you're talking to, which is such a fundamental thing about the way we communicate. And it astounds me that that's not already a thing, but I think Facebook is a very good example of how difficult it is to understand even the privacy implications of the fact that Facebook knows all your stuff. Just it's hard to tell who you're sharing.
Exactly.
You
know, and
who you're
sharing.
There's
so many settings and so many controls.
Yeah, exactly. And every time
the implications aren't even obvious.
Yeah, and every time you change something, then it's like, okay, is that a cascading effect? Like on if you share a post on your Facebook and you're like, oh wait, I don't want this to go out to, you know, my family, so I'm gonna remove them from this list. The next time you post, it's not going out to your family anymore. It automatically changes your defaults, which is a really confusing thing to do. And also it's very, very, very difficult to tell that that's happening. Unless you already know it's doing that. So that's one aspect that I'm focusing on. And then the other one is content filtering, right? Because we have this constant deluge of information that may or may not be relevant or that we may or may not just want to see. A friend of mine the other day was complaining to me about how she has some good friends whose political views she wants absolutely nothing to do with.
Oh, that's never happened anywhere else.
And she doesn't want to see that on Facebook. It's like she just doesn't want to be. It's not a conversation that she would normally be having with that person because she deliberately avoided
that. Yeah.
But then it shows up on Facebook, and there's no way around it. So you either just unsubscribe from everything that that person is creating. It's like, well, now I just don't see any updates from them. Or you're forced to see the political things. Now, on the flip side, it's difficult. That's also a transparency issue, right? And Facebook has gotten backlash for trying to do those kinds of algorithms in a very opaque way. Probably the most well-known one is when they were doing the study on the emotional effects of how people post and how emotions are transmitted through statuses and things like that. And I think there are some really important ethical implications of that study, and like that's a whole separate conversation entirely, but people got really mad about that because it was handled so opaquely. And I think the study was something about it, the title of the study was something about emotional contagion. But people got really, really frustrated about that, as right they should be. I was one of the people that was very troubled by that because there was no transparency. There was no opt-in process. It was just, you know, we're going to do this. And so the transparency of filtering is a big part too, but I think it's crucial to get the filtering right, because again, otherwise you're just sitting there confronted by a bombardment.
Are you addressing kind of a certain type of user or market or customer to get started?
To an extent. I think in particular there's an age group that has just graduated college and is starting to work that is and even towards the tail end of college, so early 20s up to mid-30s, I would say, has a lot of problems with Facebook, but they haven't quite left yet because there's enough inertia in their lives around Facebook. I haven't left Facebook primarily because I organize some things out of Facebook. And if I left Facebook, then it's going to be really difficult for me to organize those, right? So my physical social life would take a hit if I left. And I think there's a lot of people that are in that situation where they're itching to leave, but there isn't really an alternative. People who are concerned with privacy to an extent, but I think more, you know, privacy is a hard thing to sell from a market perspective to consumers, not necessarily because it's, you know, inherently this thing, but because we've always done a terrible job of explaining it. And it's not easy to explain. I mean, if you try and explain like the intricacies of cryptography to someone who has no tech background, good luck. I mean, even people that do have tech backgrounds, that's a really tough thing to understand. So, you know, I think that the blame for that falls on us as a group of people creating technology as much as it does on people who are apathetic about it. The fact remains, it's a difficult thing to just sell privacy or sell security as just a core point. So, I'm primarily focused around people that are in that age group and are really not content with Facebook. There are a lot of people that, to an extent, anything but Facebook would be an acceptable thing. It's a little hard to define any specific demographic with that because Facebook's users are such a wide demographic.
Yeah, and ultimately, like, half people. You never quite know who's going to start using the product.
Exactly.
They're going to say, this works really well for me, and I think I'm going to connect up some of my friends. And it can be totally surprising to the originators what audience it actually ends up resonating with.
Yep, exactly. And that's kind of my situation where I have a vague idea of the audience that I'm pursuing with it, but frankly, until I actually have something out in the wild that people can use, even just a video of what it's going to be, which is probably going to be a Kickstarter video coming up pretty soon, even just that is enough to start to get some feedback. But the only feedback I've gotten has been on the protocol, which is really important feedback to have, but you know, isn't necessarily something that can gear me towards understanding.
No, do you envision this protocol as something that once you've got the network built, that you see other apps and add-ons and social networks hopefully adopting the protocol as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the hope. You never want something like that to be monolithic, and that's kind of so the social network itself hopefully will be, make its own money, right? You need to have self-standing things or they won't be self-sustaining. So that's important, but the real money to be made, I think, is in the monetization of a platform, right? Because there's way, way, way more applications of the protocol than just social networks, right? It's really, because it's at such a low level, it's meant to do anything social, right? And when you think about it, any network application that tries to deal with an entity as opposed to an IP address is social, right? In some way, shape, or form. If you're considering social entities, social agents to be something that produces, uses data, right, then that's anything. So the implications of that are tremendously, tremendously broad. And that's really where you make your money. I absolutely see the platform as something that could be broadly usable. The question of making that happen is sort of a totally different thing entirely.
Now, one part I'm not quite connecting in my mind here, kind of the connection from, you got the protocol, the social network, but then we talked earlier about the work you did with Git and with collaboration around that. Is there kind of a bigger circle that goes around
that? Okay, so I mentioned that I have a problem with version control being process management versus state management. As we've seen it, process management and how I think it should be state management. So kind of awkwardly married with that is the question of identity management, right? So Git sort of does this in the sense that you can attach an email to things. But it doesn't really actually do it in the sense that there's no veracity of the email. There's actually an interesting...
It's just a string that's passed in.
Yeah, exactly. And there is an interesting thing that happened, probably 5 or 6 months ago, where someone spoofed Linus Torvalds' email address in order to just make a point that, like, hey, we're even GitHub is... And it showed up as a commit on GitHub, and they were saying, hey, even GitHub is depending upon this... email field as a way of authenticating people, and this is not, a secure way in any way, shape, or form of doing that. And so kind of awkwardly intermingled in this is this question of identity management. How do you approach that? And version control, I mean, if you're not working alone, which most people aren't, then version control is inherently collaboration. So there's this massive social element that's a part of it. And as it turns out, when you have a platform and in this case a protocol that's intended to very efficiently manage any sort of collaboration or social environment, it becomes a lot easier to build version control systems on top of it. And so from a longer term prospect, probably more like a medium term prospect, one of the early internal tools that I would like to build for my company is a version control system, because that's I've seen it. I've seen a lot of my friends at various companies have told me plenty of stories about the process of leaving Git for something else. And it turns out that Git doesn't scale that well for a variety of reasons. And you can make it scale, but it takes a lot of upfront cost to do that. And so alternatively, because I have actually not just this question of identity management, right? Kind of glossed over it, but content management is an inherent part of what I'm doing because I've separated out the sort of body of the email, to use the same metaphor, from the actual access control. You then have to have a mechanism by which you can reliably and always correlate those two, right? So you have to have a very, 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 very basic addressing scheme between the two of them, or you'll lose content. You'll end up with the equivalent of 404s left and right. So that's already a particular kind of state management system. So as it turns out, building a version control system on top of the protocol that I have for the state management side of it is a pretty simple thing to do.
Okay.
If you're talking about things like merging, now you're talking about process control, right? And that's a much, much more difficult thing. If you wanted to create a merge tool to handle when you have merge conflicts, then you know that's a different question unto itself. Although fortunately, that's a question that there's a lot of there's already a lot of open source work into that specific problem. So that's kind of a tangential thing. So okay. Yeah.
Now, how does AWS in the cloud factor into all of this?
So we have, currently our code status is not where I would like it to be because I'm always kind of impatient with that stuff. I've done several experiments with previous versions of the protocol, but I actually have not finished the first implementation of the protocol as it stands now. Protocol is pretty stable, so I'm at a point where that's kind of the next step after funding of some sort. But the idea behind using... So I've been using AWS for all of the experimentation because it's a really convenient way to eliminate all of the... Well, not all, but the vast majority of the operations infrastructure overhead that you'd otherwise have. And so that's... basically, the goal is to have the platform be hosted on AWS or, you know, generic cloud service providers, but right now AWS is the easiest one for me to integrate. So have the platform itself hosted on AWS and then spit out what amounts to API calls from that. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's a reasonably accurate metaphor for it. In the meantime, I've already spit up the basic end of that infrastructure. Basically, it's an Nginx front end that's, well, load balancer at the very front end, passing through to EC2 instances and then going through into Nginx. There's a for the protocol stuff that's then being passed through to UWSGI to run Python code. But then simultaneously, currently because we have such a low load, this is all running on the same servers.
But conceptually, well,
yeah,
well,
so
separated.
Conceptually, it'll be, yeah, eventually it'll be separated. But simultaneously, right now, we're also running all of our actual website front end on the same servers. And so that's actually, it's a really, I'm a big fan of the static server paradigm where you just, every time, you use the load balancer to just transparently swap out new servers, and you run and test server updates on instances that aren't exposed to the web,
mm-hmm.
And then just cycle through them as you go.
Yeah, rather than updating things in place.
Yeah, exactly. Which is always risky. And then it's like, can I do this at a scheduled downtime interval, or like how am I going to deal with that situation? It's kind of a complicated thing as opposed to what I've been doing is with the static server approach and just using actually an auto scaling group with a backup instance to do the holdover as the instance switches over.
I think I saw a reInvent t-shirt that says something to the effect of, I never SSH to my servers and neither should you, something like that. So I think that's the same basic philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and if you do it right, you know, other than the time, if you do it right, that's a really good way of doing it. Right now, I'm not quite at that point yet because that's a significant quantity of optimization that I'm not currently at an appropriate point to do that. You know, it's not necessarily a focus. So
yeah, you have to pick and choose your battles.
Yeah, exactly, right, exactly.
So you talked a little bit about Kickstarter. So what are you hoping to accomplish with that?
Yeah, so I'm going to be in the next probably month or so pushing for a Kickstarter campaign. I'm right now in the process of creating documentation. I've been in the process of creating documentation for a while, which for me, I love talking about this informally, but then creating formal documentation is a really difficult thing to do. One, because it has to appeal to such a broad audience, and you have to know what your audience is, but then also good technical writing is profoundly difficult, particularly for things that people aren't necessarily used to. And this is a brand new protocol, so by definition, everything is something that people aren't used to. And so I've been in the process of producing a lot of documentation on what I'm doing in the hopes of, you know, kind of having, for lack of a better way of describing it, press outreach on what I'm doing before I go through Kickstarter. There's this whole pre-Kickstarter process that is very important to build up early momentum. And
yeah, there's definitely some best practices around how to run an incredibly successful campaign.
Definitely. Yeah. And Kickstarter is as much about awareness as it is about money, right? And so a really important part about that, again, is that process of building awareness beforehand, so then you can use Kickstarter as a vehicle to then snowball on your awareness. And even if someone's not necessarily contributing to your campaign, they're still, oh, hey, I'm aware of this thing and I would like to be notified about it in the future.
Yeah, so. And in fact, the awareness and having the fans out there and that are simply rooting for you and that are kind of expressing their support just by letting you know that they think it's mm-hmm. something worthwhile doing is actually really important.
Well, especially for something like a social network, right? I mean, for a social network, ideally, so in my case, part of the reason why I'm doing a decent amount of thought into this, I was struggling with it for a while about whether it's appropriate to do a Kickstarter now or do a Kickstarter later. I suppose you can always do a second. Pebble is actually a reasonably good example of in a totally different sphere of someone doing that, but was debating whether or not it would be a good idea to do it now or to do it once I have something that people could actually sign up for, right? Because in that sense, you know, if you have something that people can sign up for, then you can just say, you know, oh, hey, like contribute money, but also you could just sign up. I struggle with that for a little bit about, you know, which one should I do? And then I hit a point in which I knew it was the right time to leave. This is when I was still working full time for the climate research company. And I hit a point where I just knew it's time for me to leave. It's time for me to go on. And
what do you think was like that internal signal that told you, okay, I'm ready to make that big leap?
I think it was a combination of, I had finished up, I was the project manager on one particular instrument, and I had just finished up rolling out a new, a total overhaul of that instrument, and which actually it looks like is going to be probably their highest volume product, which is kind of cool, and a whole bunch of other stuff like that. And I was, to be totally honest, I was getting pretty frustrated with some of the, shall we say, administrative red tape that I was running into.
Sure.
And
you really wanted to focus on the doing rather than the talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And being micromanaged and things like that. But I think more importantly, from the standpoint of like me actually working on this project, was I hit a point in which I knew that, you know what? Hey, I need to. If I'm going to get money for this, I need to just focus on this full time, right? However, I'm going to do this, now is the time.
You actually need to send the signal to the audience.
Yeah,
that says
exactly.
It's important enough to you that you quit your day job.
Exactly.
And you're now putting your whole heart and soul into it.
Yeah, and I hit a point too where it's just like the protocol. There's one last change that happened, not major, but it was a moderate change to the protocol that happened. And as soon as I made that, like all of the pieces just fell into place, and I started to look at it as kind of a mature protocol as opposed to, you know, this kind of thing that I've been working on. And that switch was when it's like, okay, now I actually want to start talking publicly.
So you felt the protocol was robust enough that you can now start, like, actually thinking about it, it's a done deed, and I can focus more on the layers above it.
Yeah, I mean, I would hesitate to ever call it a done deed, but it hit the point where I was happy enough with it to be looking for public feedback.
Or what they call it, sometimes good enough to criticize?
Yes, exactly. And I think that, more than anything, there were some other kind of coincidental timing things that contribute to the actual, you know, that leap, and were reinforcing that decision. But really, I think, at the end of the day, that's what it boiled down to is, you know, I knew it's time for me to be working on this. And it is the one thing, more than anything, that I want to be working on right now. So it was, I think it was the right leap to make at the right time.
Okay. Now, at this point, do you have a public repo? Do you have web pages? Are there things that people can look at?
I've got web pages. I was actually working on some documentation immediately before coming here. There's a GitHub repo for the company that has, I'm about probably a quarter of the way through rewriting the white paper for the protocol. I had a white paper up, but it was pretty sparse on technical details. It was more of a design philosophy document than a white paper. So I'm in the process of rewriting that. The web page for the social network, ether.net, E-T-H-Y-R, is it's up and running. It's not necessarily the best design thing in the world, but it's doing the job right now. There's a mailing list associated with that, and there's, more importantly, a blog associated with that that goes through in, I think, fairly digestible chunks of what's going on with the protocol. And that's obviously an ongoing process, but that's kind of my big push right now is getting getting feedback on both the blog and the protocol documentation on GitHub, as well as getting people's email address.
Excellent. Wrapping up, any advice you might have for aspiring entrepreneurs that are kind of in that, like, working for the big company and have the great idea?
Yeah.
What should they do?
I mean, there's a point at which you have to just jump into it. Some people will say you'll just know. And for me, it was a much more gradual process. There was, you know, there were a couple weeks in which that dawning happened a lot more quickly than it had for the rest of the time I was there. But it's not necessarily something that you just wake up and know. Some people do, some people don't. But it is really important to just take that step, and sometimes you just have to go for it. But at the same rate, you know, don't do that naively. I cannot tell you the number of times that I went through the numbers on how long I can financially last before quitting my job. You know, these are things, take risks, but make sure they're calculated and informed ones.
Excellent. Great advice. Well, wish you the best.
Thank you.
Hope to hear back that things are up and running. You got the Kickstarter going.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before too long.
I'm excited about it.
Wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
This has been the AWS Podcast. I'm Jeff Barr, coming to you from the AWS Loft in San Francisco. And this podcast is part of the Intel Startup Spotlight. Thanks for listening.